Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Food has an intangible side far beyond its nourishment. For example, certain foods can recall places. I mention lasagna or crusty country bread or shrimp etouffee. A certain place would probably come to mind. But more importantly, food can connect with other people. Maybe a tomato sauce that's simmered all day or fried chicken. Those images and those foods bring a loved one to mind. My guest today has written extensively about why food is pivotal in our lives far beyond the table. Lisa Catherine Harper, along with Caroline Grant, have been writing about family food for 5 years on their blog Learning to Eat. And over those years, they've written about practical recipes, special meals for celebration, and how their families relate to food, and how those table experiences create a special time in their own families. Their new book presents 28 original essays by a variety of writers, journalists, chefs, parents, and food writers, about the various ways foods have brought people together in their lives. The Cassoulet That Saved Our Marriage, True Tales of Food, Family, and How We Learn to Eat, describe how we teach our children about food, how we learn from our own parents and others about food, and how food continues to be a bond with those we love. Lisa Catherine Harper has written extensively for a variety of publications and teaches writing at the University of San Francisco's MFA program in writing. And she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Lisa Harper, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You and your co-editor and co-blogger, Caroline Grant, have been writing about food for a number of years. How did the two of you get together and starting the blog first and now this new book, The Cassoulet, which saved our marriage, which is a great title, by the way.
Thank you. The title comes from one of the essays in the book, which I can talk about a little bit later. But Caroline and I first met through our editorial correspondence for Literary Mama. I had submitted essays to her, and she had published one of my essays in her first book, Mama PhD. And we met one day early on in our friendship with our kids in a park, and we had the brilliant idea to bring lunch. And as we brought out all of our food, you know, that's always kind of the moment of truth when you have a new mom friend and you bringing your kids to a picnic or to a restaurant. What am I going to eat? What are my kids going to eat? You know, are they going to like my food? Are they going to like my friend's food? And there's a lot of judgment around family food and around how we feed our kids. And we got to talking as our kids ate, without incident, of course, because they usually do. We got to talking about the fact that there probably was a bigger story beyond what we fed our kids, which is to say nobody was talking much about how we feed our kids, why we feed our kids, what the larger circumstances of a family food culture might be. And there are lots and lots of places where you can go to get information about the best way to feed your kids, about local, sustainable, organic, you know, less sugar, less salt, less processed foods. There's lots and lots of talk about that and rules and judgment, and a lot less talk about family food culture, namely how you feed them and why you feed them and who you feed. And so we wanted to write those other stories. So we started the blog, which is called Learning to Eat. And the blog circles around stories about family food, not just what we feed, but why we feed our kids what we feed them. And the book grew out of that.
Yeah. I was struck by something you said right at the beginning. It was just, you know, all these issues that go around with one family meeting another and eating their food. I mean, for generations, that wasn't a big issue. You know, the food might be a little different. It might be more homemade food. It may be a little more processed. But we didn't worry about those things for the longest time. And just, you know, since all the, you know, the issues of processed food and what goes into the food you eat, and that's all become these negotiable territories now.
And I'm not quite sure why that happened, but, you know, there is a whole market now for kids' food, you know, and there's the assumption when you go to restaurants that the kids are going to eat off the kids' menu or that there are special foods that you should only feed kids. And part of me suspects that, it's a marketing issue. It's a consumer issue. It's a way to sell more of a particular thing. But I'm not so sure that it's healthy for the food culture, because then your kids' food is fragmented or fractured or separate from the family food, and they eat one thing and you eat another, and that becomes very stressful for the parent. And I think that we would probably do well to have a family food culture that's more inclusive, where the kids eat portions or parts or smaller amounts or deconstructed versions of what the adults are eating.
That's a theme that's sort of common in some of the essays that are there in the collection. Jeff Gordon here, he writes about how he'd eat anything growing up.
Yeah.
And his family was one where, you know, he's eating oysters Rockefeller at, you know, 8 or 9, 10 years old, and his kids won't eat anything, which is, of course, you know, for anybody who loves food, it's like all of a sudden your kids, you know, nothing but macaroni and cheese and hamburgers. You know, that's sort of the curse, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, and he's devastated by it because here is a guy who loves to eat. You know, he's a food journalist. He writes about food for a living, and his kids are really, really picky. And he's disappointed, and he struggles with it. You know, not so much because he wants them to be healthy or he wants them to be food snobs, but because he feels like food is a way to introduce them to pleasure. It's a way to introduce them to larger cultures. It's a way to give them access to a greater world. So, you know, he keeps trying, you know, little bits here, little bits there, you know, with the hope that as you keep reintroducing certain foods to your kids and familiarizing them, someday, maybe, hopefully, they'll come around. We have another essay about the same kind of thing, Danny Klein's essay about her kids who only eat white food. And it makes her crazy. It's a very, very funny piece.
Yes,
you know, if it's not white, they won't eat it. But she struggles with their pickiness for different reasons. She worries that they're not healthy, that they're not growing. You know, there are different reasons why we worry about whether our kids are picky. And she gets the same advice from her pediatrician. They said, look at your kid. Your kid is healthy. Your kid is growing. Your kid is not failing to thrive. Just introduce one food a week and stop stressing out about it so much. And so she tries to do that.
Yeah, a bite of broccoli.
And sometimes that's all you do. I mean, this story is not in the book, but my son ate only basically rice and potatoes for about 2 years. He ate everything, stopped eating everything, and then after about 2 years, he slowly started eating everything, and it was just a matter of being patient.
Well, in your book, you have three different sections. One is on food, family, and then learning to eat. Those last two essays you mentioned come from the learning to eat section. Can you sort of give us a breakdown of the three sections and how you wanted to put these essays together?
Yes, the first section really is about, the first section food is really about particular foods that kind of cement a family, like the particular food tradition. So, for instance, you know, Barbara Reshkoff writes about kosher food and what that meant in her family of origin and what it means for her now. Disha Filia writes about soul food and being raised on these wonderful traditions of Southern African-American cooking, ham hocks, collard greens, fried chicken, and her struggle to keep those traditions alive in her family and also maintain a healthier food culture. The second section, family, is really about the relationships that are forged at our table and within our family food life. So, for instance, Max Brooks has an absolutely beautiful essay about his mother, Anne Bancroft's organic garden, and who would have known, right? You know, he writes about, you know, these wonderfully funny, smart books about zombies, and I thought at first that the interest in organic farming came from, you know, apocalyptic culture, but really it was from his mother, who always, always had an organic garden, and he talks about continuing that tradition with his son. There's a great essay in the section Family about Table Talk by Catherine Newman, who writes about how family dinner was the worst part of her life when she had young children and how it's become the very best part of her life as her kids have grown, and she's fostered this kind of wonderful, daily, exuberant conversation around the table, and she gives some suggestions about how to do that.
And this is a big issue today because so many people don't have a family meal every day. It's eat on the go, you know, quick microwave something, sitting around the living room, maybe watching television or going off your separate ways. And this has become a big issue in food culture overall, the idea of the family meal and how important it is to the family.
You know, it's a huge issue. And one of the things that was interesting for Caroline and I, Rich, when we were compiling these essays, is that as the stories started coming in, we realized we didn't just have really nice, sentimental happy stories about family food. We had some really devastating stories about how death, illness, divorce, fractured families, those kinds of traumatic relationships also played out at the family table. It's not so much that your food culture causes trouble in your family, but it reflects the larger things that are going on in your family. And it was important for us to show that, you know, the larger relationships in your family are absolutely played out around the table. So, you know, one of the things that I think you can take from this section, family, is that even if only two members of your family are sitting down for dinner because the other two, one's at work, one's at soccer practice, you know, make that 20 minutes or make that half an hour with your one child or your spouse or your two children, make that matter. Pay attention to what's going on around you. Pay attention to the food. Pay attention to the person that you're eating with. But really think not just about what you're eating, but how you're eating it and who you're eating it with. And I think that's one step that we can take in a very busy modern family culture to make your family food matter a little bit more and a little bit healthier.
My guest today is Lisa Catherine Harper. She's a co-editor with Caroline Grant of the collection The Cassolet Saved Our Marriage, True Tales of Food, Family, and How We Learn to Eat. And they also run the website Learning to Eat, which is all about these same sort of stories. Now, this collection has about 30 essays, of which maybe only one or two have appeared in other places. So you really commissioned most of these writers to write an essay on food, or they'd been writing about food, so it was a natural fit.
We did. You know, so Jeff Gordner, for instance, he's a food journalist, so we knew that he could write about food, but, you know, he gives us a more personal story for the book than he usually writes about for the New York Times. But other writers we went to because we knew that they didn't normally write about food, and we thought that they might have something interesting to say. We wanted to get kind of out of the run-of-the-mill family food writing. We wanted, so for instance, you know, we have the story by Max Brooks, who doesn't write about food. We have a story by Bethany Saltman, who's a Buddhist, who usually writes about parenting and issues of spirituality, but she wrote us an essay about reconciling her relationship with her late father by making his gravy for the Thanksgiving table. The title essay is by Deborah Kogan, who's a novelist. She wrote a memoir and she has a book of essays, but she's a novelist. She really doesn't write about food at all, but I'd loved her writing and went to her and I said, do you perchance have a story about family food that you'd like to contribute to our book? And she said, well, I don't actually really cook, but I'd love to write this piece with my husband about how his food and his cooking really got our family through a rough patch. And so they gave us the title essay, which is a series of letters written back and forth between the husband and the wife about the cassolet that saved their marriage, which is a French dish. It's a casserole. It takes made of duck and
sausages,
tomatoes and white beans and sausage and delicious
thing. It's incredibly time-consuming to make, and in fact, in this case, it's like a 4 or 5 day process.
Yes,
and they always
exactly.
invite a lot of friends over. And I love there was a phrase in that was so good. It was like we're at the. I'm paraphrasing now, but it's we're on the road and we're at the crossroads between making it work and irreconcilable differences, which was just a wonderful. And the cassolet was, this was like one of the best days of their year. They would have this yearly cassolet, invite friends over, and it was just a really wonderful essay.
It's a beautiful essay, and the thing that's really wonderful about it is that, you know, it really does suggest that, you know, making a marriage work, making any kind of long-term relationship work, you have to work at it day by day and little by little and chip away at it, and that's how you have to make a cassolet. It's just one step at a time, and you know, the whole dish is bigger than the sum of its parts, and that really is what the essay is about, and it's really what the marriage is about as well. So again, you know, the full range of our human relationships can be implicated in the food that we cook and serve and eat with the people that we love the best.
Now, at the end of each essay, there's usually a recipe, and in fact, the cassolet recipe is there, and I'm looking at it. It starts on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
and it's on Sunday.
It does, yes. I have not tackled that yet, but I think next winter maybe I will. But they do it every year. They did it again this year in February. You know, the Cassoulet, I don't know if the Cassoulet was the only thing that saved their marriage, but they're still, the couple is still married, and they still had a Cassoulet Day this year, and the tradition continues.
Well, let's talk about some of the other essays. The one that was previously published, it was in Gourmet, as Alexandra Crapanzano's story of summering out on, I assume it's Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket or somewhere like that, somewhere along the northeastern coastline. And Alexandra loves to cook, but they have this relative who lives on a Spartan diet. It's a great aunt or something like that. And
right.
Through the course of this essay, she discovers what it's like to eat real food. And it is a wonderful, wonderful essay.
Yes, she has to win over her then boyfriend, later husband's 82-year-old great aunt Margaret, who only eats boiled food. And she has these really funny traditions, like the lobster has to be boiled in seawater, but she boils it for 18 and a half minutes. which ruins the lobster, and it horrifies Alexandra the first time she has to do it. The aunt will only eat margarine, and so just shopping for her is completely out of Alexandra's comfort zone. But, you know, she very slowly begins to reintroduce new foods into the diet over the summer, and she begins to cook things like she likes boiled things. So she said, okay, well, I'll simmer a pork loin in milk, which is this very sort of delicious Italian dish, and that's the recipe in the book. And she slowly starts to, you know, not only win over the aunt's affection and develop this very close and substantial relationship with her, but she also changes her diet in the process, and they have these wonderful summers together where they do create new traditions and have new foods, and the three of them form a very intimate family unit.
But eventually, it's a story of her aging too, but the one constant is going out for the seawater for the lobster boil, which is it's a beautiful, beautiful story.
It is beautiful, and it continues then after Alexandra and John are married and they have their own child, and they continue to go and get the seawater in which to boil the lobster, although she does manage to reduce the cooking time so that, you know, the lobster's not ruined in the end. And I think it really does speak to the way that traditions emerge, the way that traditions are made. They're acquired from things that your loved ones do, things you've been doing, and things that that change slowly over the years.
Chris Malcolm comes from a family of restaurateurs in, I think it's Boston, I believe.
Yes,
and
yes.
His story is about the red sauce, which in this day and age, you know, how many of us will actually take time to actually cook a red sauce? But that's the family tradition, and he writes about that red sauce and how that has sustained his family over generations, really.
It really is generations, and the really interesting thing about Chris's essay is that he thought he was eating one red sauce for his whole life. You know, the red sauce that his great-grandfather brought over from Italy and started with the restaurant and cooked in the restaurant and passed on to his son. Chris's grandfather then passed on to his mother, and there's a very funny, he tells the funny story in the book about how when his mother asked her father for the red sauce recipe, he gave her the industrial recipe, which, you know, could feed an army. And she had to, over the years, figure out how to adapt that for a single family. So she was making, you know, just maybe a couple of gallons as opposed to
50.
vast of it. But he always thought that the red sauce that his grandfather cooked in the restaurant was the same red sauce that his mother cooked in the house, and then he finds out as an adult that she's changed the recipe, and he's kind of shocked and slightly horrified and eventually amused, and he understands that, you know, food traditions, like all traditions, are living, and they do change and they do adapt, and we do make them our own, and that's one of the beautiful things about them. But it's a great story of the family through this constantly changing, evolving, living recipe.
There's another essay I found really interesting. It was from Sarah Shea, and it was about, you know, she's a Midwestern girl. She lived on a farm, and in the Midwest, when you live on a farm at the harvest time, you have men coming in, and the women's part of the women's role is to cook for those men as they're conducting the harvest. And they would be these great big farm meals. And yet here she's living in Brooklyn, and she's away from that. And all of a sudden, there's a crew of Polish workers renovating an apartment or a house across the street. And all of a sudden, she's reverting to this old role. And it's really a touching essay, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great piece because she sees these workers show up and she thinks, I need to feed them. That's what you do. That's the right thing to do. That's how people take care of each other. And that's how you show, you know, and create community is by cooking for people who are working for you. So they were fixing her brownstone, the courtyard in her brownstone, for the whole summer. And she would continually cook for them, and she played jokes for them when they didn't like her food. Then she would do things like, okay, well, you're not going to eat my food today. I'm just going to cook you one cookie, and I'll divide it into 12 parts, and you can have that. But she did, you know, succeed in creating this really wonderful, you know, community with them. And I think her neighbors thought she was a little bit crazy, but she brought those Midwestern values to this Brooklyn brownstone. And, you know, she fed them and she showed them her gratitude. And I think she also really nourished herself and remembered where she came from. And I think that's one of the interesting things about the stories in the book, too, is that, you know, it absolutely shows that American food culture is not singular. People from New York will cook differently and eat differently than people from the Midwest, and will cook and eat differently from people in California. We come from different places. We have different foods available. We have different kinds of cultures. You know, you might not have a lobster boil in the Midwest, but you will perhaps feed your community in larger way in other ways.
You have a fried chicken feast or something like that.
Yeah. Or, you know, you'll feed the workers. You'll feed the workers on your farm. A rural tradition is not the same as an urban tradition, you know, as a Cassoulet Day. but we all do have things that we are already doing. And I think that we need to remember that more.
Earlier we talked about how some of the writers are looking at food currents where their own generation to their children's generations. Several of the essays also look at how they're different from their parents. Melissa Clark and Lisa McNamara are two essays which do this, which is sort of, Melissa Clark was, mother was a great cook, but she never learned to cook, and finally she's watching Rachel Ray and learns how to cook, and then finally makes a dinner for her mother, and it was the best gift ever. Yeah, it was a wonderful essay.
Yeah, thank you. It is a great essay. I love that one because it's funny and it's sweet, and it is absolutely honest. You know, Melissa, I've known Melissa for a very long time, and I knew that her mother knew how to cook, and I knew that Melissa really didn't like to cook at all. I was like, can you please write this for me? But the thing about Melissa's essay that's really interesting is that it shows that family food culture is not just about feeding your kids. Sometimes it's about feeding your parents. And you create, you know, horizontal relationships with your spouse or with your sibling. You know, Jen Larson talks about being fed by her brother, but Melissa talks about what it meant to feed her mother and giving her that gift of a meal. And you know, Lisa McNamara started to bake partly because her mother didn't allow sweets in the house. And she kind of baked sort of furtively on her own, and then she was taught to bake by housekeepers, by her brother, and then her mother died when she was quite young of an illness. And baking and feeding her friends became a way of making connections with other people and finding love and fostering relationships. And she bakes, you know, these really amazing pies and cakes, and food really became a way of, or baking became a way of creating her own community in the absence of her mother.
My guest today is Lisa Catherine Harper, co-editor with Caroline Grant of the essay collection, The Cassoulet That Saved Our Marriage, True Tales of Food, Family, and How We Learn to Eat. And both you and Caroline have essays as well. I'm very jealous of you because you have an orange tree in your backyard.
We have a beautiful orange tree in our backyard. It must be 50 years old, and it's gorgeous, and we ignore it completely, by which I mean we hardly ever prune it. We don't bother watering it, and it thrives. And right now, the oranges are dropping off faster than we can eat them, and the blossoms are coming out, and it's fragrant and gorgeous and beautiful. But the thing that I write about in my essay is that the orange tree is so completely ordinary for my children. But I grew up on the East Coast with, you know, frozen orange juice. We never had a fresh orange that wasn't shipped from, you know, from Florida. Because it's so ordinary for them, it's become a really kind of important part of the rhythm of our life. You know, we have juice and we have snacks all winter long, and we have, you know, this beautiful tree to picnic under right now in the spring, and it's in that rhythm. And just recognizing the rhythm of this very simple orange tree, that I know that my kids have something special in their food life. We have this tradition of the tree.
And that's one of the beautiful things about food, the cycle of foods. You know, whether it's oranges in California in the late winter, early spring. Here in Oklahoma, we're going to be in strawberry season anytime, asparagus season already. And there's something about those foods that you just crave for that moment when they're absolutely at their freshest.
You do, and I think that's what thinking about this essay and this story and thinking about what story I wanted to tell for the book about my own food life. And I think that when you stop and think, even if it's just strawberry season, or even if it's just an orange tree, even if that's the only local, only seasonal thing you eat, it teaches you to pay attention, and it teaches you to pay attention to your food, and then hopefully it teaches you to pay attention to your family in the moment just a little bit more than you might have another time of the year. But I think that ability that the seasonal food sometimes has to make you stop and pay attention and say, this is the right thing at the right moment, and it's not going to last, and I'm going to enjoy it and appreciate it and give thanks and gratitude for it and sustain not just, you know, my body and my health, but also sustain my relationships at the same time. I think that kind of closes the circle of our family food.
Well, and you can read more every day at your blog, Learning to Eat. And the name of the book is The Cassoulet Saved Our Marriage. And Lisa, we appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Rich. It's been my pleasure.
Lisa Catherine Harper, along with Caroline Grant, are the editors of The Cassoulet That Saved Our Marriage, True Tales of Food, Family, and How We Learn to Eat. They also co-write the blog, Learning to Eat. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rich Fisher.